Welcome to the Gamers Inn. Come on in, pull up a chair next to the fire. It looks like you've had a long journey. I'm your host, Jocelyn, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Ryan. Hello, Ryan.
Hello. I was wondering, like, we talked about this pre-show about, like, we're going to struggle to hit an hour. We always talk about, like, you shouldn't really say that because then you'll go super long. You'll have, like, an hour and a half episode or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be talking about unions or lawsuits or whatever for 45 minutes after, you know, talking about unicorns for a half hour. And that is a game I'm playing. That's not even a game.
Yeah, that's Jocelyn's not even a playing. Me game.
But I always wonder, like, you know, we say don't bring it up, but then maybe it's like a haunting. Like, you have to acknowledge it in the room in order maybe. For it to go away. So, like, me talking about it isn't necessarily meaning we're going to have the core curse where we go for 4.5 hours. We're actually going to be like a tight 1 hour normal Gamers in good stuff.
You know what we should do? We should really dig into this idea, this concept that you've had. We should talk about it for about like half an hour, 45 minutes, like really get into the nitty gritty of whether we should mention it or not before getting into the main show. And then, just kidding.
No, like intro banter is scheduled for another 4 minutes. So I think we're good.
Okay.
So, you know. How you doing? How are things going?
Things are going pretty good. Getting a whole lot of sleep right now, but that's okay.
That's par for the course.
Yeah, par for the course.
You know, I will tell this story. So lately, so we've reshuffled the whole house. So we have, you know our place.
Yes, I know the layout.
And we moved all the kids into their own bedrooms. So now Ashley and I's bedroom is in technically one of
the
living room, and the kids won't go to the bathroom by themselves. They will wake up. They will walk all the way downstairs. And sometimes I don't even hear them because I'm so deeply asleep. And then I'll wake up and Abby's just standing next to the side of the bed.
Oh my God.
Dad, I gotta go pee.
No offense to your kids, but like of all of them, I would be the most terrified to wake up to Abby standing over me.
Yeah.
Like, I love her, but that girl is like, she's wild. Like, you never know what she's going to do. So, like, there's an equal parts I have to pee or I'm going to murder you now.
Yeah.
I would expect either to come out of her.
And she sleeps with the dog now. So she'll bring, okay. So she's got like this little purse dog or whatever that she'll bring down with her. As she's like, and then hovering over the bed and just like, Daddy, I gotta go pee. It's like, you made it all the way downstairs through the dark, no lights turned on.
Past two bathrooms, too.
Yes, on the way.
On the way to get to you from where she is.
So I gotta get up, you know, go into the bathroom, you know, turn the light on, try not to blind all of us. And then, you know, when she's done in the bathroom and it's like, okay, good night, she goes, off she goes. Dog in hand, back to bed. And it's all that to be said, you know, like really until you kick them out of the house, I think they're going to wake you up at least once a week. So.
Oh, okay. I was like, how are we tying this back to video games? I'm very curious.
No, we're not at all.
Not that I want to play a game that's like bathroom simulator or something, but like maybe that's where he's going with this.
No, just that, you know, if you want to tie it back to video games, it means if you're being woken up by your kids, you're probably too tired to play video games.
Yeah, I am definitely passing out like 4 to 5 hours earlier than I used to, which is absolutely wild for me. Like, I was a diehard go to bed at 2 a.m. person. And now I'm like 9 o'clock. Jesus. Oh, my God. How am I not in bed yet?
Yeah, she says as we're starting the show at 9.
Yeah, as the show is 9:10. Oh, God.
Yeah, we'll get there. All right. That's 5 minutes. I think we're good. We can move into the games now.
Yay. We did the banter portion. Huzzah. Well, I'm excited to hear about unicorns because unicorns.
Right, that's very true. So let's talk about Unicorn Overlord, which I don't want you to fall asleep now. This is a tactical RPG with some overworld exploration. This is a game by Vanillaware, which is known for their past titles, most recently 13 Sentinels, which we did do a game club for. Led by Jimmy the Shovel, was a fantastic experience. A game that, you know, is very well known for its story. And then Vanillaware has a very distinct art style. Like they have a very distinct sort of art style that if you see it, you'll be like, okay, like you'd recognize the games. And Unicorn Overlord is very much an extension of what we saw within 13 Sentinels. What makes this one unique is that it is a tactical RPG similar to Fire Emblem in the feel of like medieval fantasy. You know, there's a big bad guy trying to take over the world, and you are the, you know, ragtag rebels trying to liberate, you know, the good guys from the bad guys.
Are you unicorns?
Well, okay. I know you want to. Yeah, let's talk about the unicorns, because I know the elephant in the room, unicorn in the room.
It's in the name.
It is. So where the unicorn comes in, there are unicorns, quite a few unicorns in terms of the iconography and stuff. The unicorn is like a sacred deity to the main good guys. And your main dude, Elaine, who's got blue hair, that's how you know, like, okay, Fire Emblem, feels very Fire Emblem, blue hair, has a ring. It's called the Unicorn Ring. I actually don't know what it's called, but it's got a unicorn on it. And essentially that ring allows our main hero to clear the corruption from people who have been sort of, brain fogged or had their brain taken over by,
okay,
you know, the bad guys. Again, like very sort of, you know, in terms of the story, it's like the story is hit and miss. You know, the overarching story of like, it feels very Fire Emblem, and that's like, okay, big bad takes over the world, wants to take over the world. There's magic involved. And they're using sorcery to sort of like bring people over to their side. And they've taken over all of the lands in this mythical, fantasy world. And, we have our, at the very beginning of the game, our main character is shepherded away from this land to be taken into protection, while his mother sacrifices herself. The queen sacrifices herself. This isn't spoilers. This all happens in the first 5 minutes.
Okay,
and she sacrifices herself to sort of, you know, save and give them time to escape. The sole heir to the kingdom. You know, so it's. Again, like for folks who've played Fire Emblem, listening to this story, it's like, okay, this sounds very familiar. And I think the overarching story of Unicorn Overlord is very like standard sort of approach to these sort of games. You know, like I feel like you could change magic for dragons and suddenly this is a Fire Emblem game. Like, if, you know, not to be too reductive here, but like I think that that's its weakest part is the story. There are moments within the story and sort of side stuff that is really interesting. So there's a whole lot you can do in this game. So I mentioned that there's an overworld exploration. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the most unique part is that you're presented with this world map. And instead of like queuing into battles and sort of moving from one point to the next, sort of, you know, Indiana Jones style, as you follow like a red line from one point to the next and queuing into different maps and chapters and stuff.
Right.
You're actually walking across this overworld map and you are engaging with citizens, cities, villages, fortresses as you are continuing your sort of path to liberate everyone from the bad guys.
So is it kind of like the overworld map in Tiny Tina's?
Maybe I didn't play that one.
Oh, okay. Okay.
If it's fully, it kind of feels like to bring it to like more of a broader sort of thing. It's like, it feels like the Super Mario sort of overworld, you know, the more recent games is.
Yeah.
Like,
okay.
Yeah. Running around this overworld and you are like a little sprite character. And you are represented as you run around, in these environments, and it's a complete map in the sense that you can move from point A to point B and there's no queuing. Like it's all connected. You can fast travel. So like it is pretty daunting when you look at how much you'll eventually unlock, but the fact that you can fast travel around kind of makes it much more approachable. But as you go, you are sort of encountering story missions, side missions, also liberation quests, which will allow you to basically queue into a small battle to wipe out the enemies that are in that area and take them over for the good guys. So they range from like little missions like that, where you are just queuing in and fighting one little battle, all the way to like actually trying to liberate like a fortress town. So early on, you come across like a fortress that's walled city, and you have to like basically siege it to get in there. And once you unlock an area, it kind of opens it up for you to explore and find resources and perform deliveries for these locations to sort of upgrade them. So there is like this feeling of accomplishment and progression, as not only are you kicking the bad guys out of the area, you're also improving the lives of these folks by, I mean, you're delivering, like, it's fetch quest stuff. You're delivering like wood and fish and apples, but, you know, suddenly makes all the windmills repaired. So that's nice. It's a visual touch. Nice visual touch. So that's one aspect that I thought was really cool. Something I haven't personally played before in a tactics game. Although I hear it heavily borrows from Tactics Ogre, which is an old school Square Enix tactics game, which this one pulls from. So it's trying to sort of pay homage to the tactics games that came in the 90s, which I don't have a lot of experience with, because in the 90s, Fire Emblem was exclusive to Japan. So I wouldn't have played those. But where the combat is really interesting is that you are meeting people constantly. So like in Fire Emblem, you'll queue into a map and then like your guys will show up, and then either a good guy or a bad guy that you can convince to join you. There's a lot of like these conversations you're having with people of like, hey, you should join our cause. Like, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. You know that guy with, he twirls his mustache when he talks? Like, he's the bad guy. We're the good guys. Blue hair, he's glowing purple. You know, he's bad, we're good. So again, like going back to the story of like, it's very clear to tell who's a good guy and who's a bad guy, even to the point where, like I said, there are good guys from the past that have been corrupted, and you use your special unicorn ring to turn them good again. And the first time you do that, it is very much like a, you know, a typical fantasy story of like, suddenly bad guy is good and all is forgiven. But there are some wrinkles to that later on. Like, they do sort of play with the expectation that like, oh, this is a good guy. Was a good guy. He's a bad guy. Now I've turned him good again. He's going to join my party, right? There's some nuance to that. So like, the story does do some interesting things, but like, the building blocks are very kind of generic, you know? But like I said, it's the combat, I think, that really makes it shine. So the combat is, you're getting all these heroes, all of different classes, all of different variations, and then you're building sort of in a grid, a formation of these units. And you have complete control over how you place them in a 3x2 grid. So 6 squares, you have a 3x2 grid, and then you have a front row and a back row. And depending on how you place your units, strategically, you need to make sure that, okay, for example, your casters, your archers, you're going to want them in the back row because they're going to be more susceptible to physical damage. You want to keep them away from that. So you put them in the back row. In the front row, you're going to want your defensible units, like your tanks, your knights, stuff like that. So pretty typical standard stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
Where they do kind of mix it up a little bit is thieves. Usually thieves would be like rogues, put them in the back line. They might, you know, do more sneak damage. But in this game, you want to put them in the front row because they have high evasion. So they're like an evasion tank, I think is what they've been called. So essentially, like, you put them in the front row, nothing's going to hit them because they have a high evasion and some passive skills. They're going to make it so people always miss. So early on in the game, you don't even need a tank. You can just put the thief front and center. Works out quite well. But like, where the combat kind of comes in, it's really unique. So like, best way I can describe it is that when you queue into these battles, kind of feels a bit like a Clash Royale type game, which I know you just played Warcraft Rumble. And
I was going to say, this is sounding so rumbly.
I know. So when you queue into a battle, you've got your post, your I don't know what they call it, but I'll call it post. And then the enemy has their final sort of like post there. And then there's some stuff in between, usually a few garrisons or a fort or whatever that you have to sort of battle to take over. And it is kind of Clash Royale because like on their end, they have like a commander who on a cooldown is sending out reinforcements. So there's constantly, you know, bad guys streaming onto the map. Again, very kind of feels Clash Royale. And you are spending valor points to summon your formations onto the battlefield. And then you are queuing them, like in a Clash Royale, to move to specific areas and either initiate combat or take over a watchtower or what have you. And the battles all happen in like automatically. So you are not, it's not a turn-based game in the sense that you are like picking your moves.
Right.
It just sort of cues in. So when an enemy approaches one of your guys, it'll initiate combat and move to what you would feel is a more traditional Fire Emblem battle screen where like the enemies are, you and the enemies are fighting. It's all animated, looks great. It's super beautiful animations and you kind of just watch it play out. You don't really in the moment have control over it, although you can kind of change up the tactics if you really want to get in there and like mess with how your units, like you have complete control over how your units approach battle. If you really want to get into it personally, like I kind of get blinders on, like I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I feel like I'm going to mess this up, but you do have the ability to change all that. And you don't have to watch it either. You can just skip the battles. Like it completely previews how things are going to work out either in your favor, you'll win or lose. And based on that, you just keep moving through the battle and, you know, make sure you have your advantages. And yeah,
I wish that there was a skip animations or skip battle button in Battlegrounds and Hearthstone. Cause that's kind of what it reminds me of, right? Like you just, you set up your battle and then you push a button and you like, and then it just kind of happens, right? Like you don't do any direct control or whatever. And then there's a winner and a loser at the end. And yeah, I understand like Hearthstone is a little bit different in that it's like obviously PvP, but still at the same time, like I wish you could just be like, okay, skip, like just tell me who won, who lost, let's go.
Yeah, I think the game really respects your time because there are going to be a lot of battles and it allows you to sort of preview even like before you're in, like for example, like I was struggling with a map and the game allows you to deploy a formation, select that formation, drag it all the way over to like tell it where to go, hover over what you want it to attack. And at that point, it'll even tell you how things are going to go. Like it'll preview how things are going to go. And you can make a decision of like, that's not the right call. So if you're like me and you forget all the time, like what beats what, whether it's, you know, rock, paper, scissors or what have you, it's not as simple as Fire Emblem where it's like sword beats axe, axe beats lance, lance beats sword. You know, it's more nuanced than that. There's a lot of like different layers and the formations will really play with that too. So you can just like deploy something and be like, oh, that's not right. And then withdraw, you get all of your valor points back. So there's no mistake made. It's very flexible. And then wait until you, and then figure out until you got the right sort of approach and go from there. So it doesn't punish you for experimenting mid battle, especially if you're like me and you don't really have a sense for the strategy quite yet. I've never been really good at min maxing with this stuff. And there are a lot of options. Like I'm maybe 10 hours in and like every encounter that isn't like a little sort of side quest, like it is recruiting a new person, you know? And for the most part, it's all new classes too. So it's whole new mechanics of like how this specific character class works. And the other cool part is like, you can actually, there's a mercenary system where you, when you encounter a new class, you can actually recruit that class as like a, just a generic character and fully customize it. Like name, voice, you know, base color, accent color, like different armor types. And even like the way they break down the stats, like you can kind of play around with the randomizer there too. And then you even give it a name and that character becomes a part of your army and you can hire them using your specific points that you earn. And I thought that was such a neat touch too. There's no permadeath. So it's not like you're replacing characters that have died in battle. It's just if you want to have 6 Griffin Riders in a formation in the late game, you can do that, even though there might only be 4 Griffin Riders that you can recruit throughout the game.
Okay, I see.
It's such a neat sort of approach in that, like, most games wouldn't give you the freedom to do that, you know? Because they'd be all about the story and wanting to be like, no, like, these characters, there's only 3 Griffin Riders, and if you don't recruit this one, then you're shit out of luck. You only got 2, you know? So it's a nice touch, but there's a lot of battles. Like, I was exploring the main area and I was like, oh, before I move on to the next area, I want to sort of explore. And I thought, oh, it's really seeming like I'm not going to be able to find anything more to do. But then all of a sudden that's like, I just kept going. I kept finding these quests to do and these little battles to queue into. And I'm like recruiting characters and new classes. And I'm like, they've hid these folks like all the way up here after I've done the main quest in this area. There's just so much. And to a certain degree, it's a bit daunting because I'm like 12 hours in, just finished the first section. I've moved into the next section and it obviously keeps going because there's like 5 different sections. And I'm excited to see where it goes. Like, I really love the animations. So like I have like, there are different like, You'll come across a new character class and it's like, oh, I haven't seen these animations yet. So like I'll watch those animations and see the combat and stuff and see how it plays out. And like it's mostly voice acted, so you might want to skip like a lot of the redundant battles, but while you make your way to the final boss. But then once you get to the final boss, you'll want to watch that combat because right. Like usually there's, you know, some voice lines and stuff. So
extra bits.
Yeah.
Some flavor.
Exactly. It's not flavor text, but it's like flavor voice acting. So
yeah.
But yeah, it's a lot of fun. Obviously, like right up my alley because I love Fire Emblem games, and I haven't played a lot of like non-Fire Emblem tactics games, although I've certainly tried them before. But this one's like very close to what I love about Fire Emblem, which are these like very colorful and vibrant and active characters that are just written in a specific way where they've got personality, you know, they aren't just like these, it's not just reading walls of text. Like it's all the main stuff is voice acted. The one complaint I have about voice acting is that the game does have support conversations between characters similar to Fire Emblem, as you like work with characters and have them like do battle with alongside each other and they'll gain support points. Those conversations aren't voice acted, and that to me is a bit of a bummer because those are some of the best conversations. And you know, the writing is really good, but I wish they had gone that extra step to voice act it. But by no means a deal breaker. Like again, like if you're into tactics games, you love Fire Emblem, you're looking for something different, this game offers that without sort of being too daunting. Like I really love that they don't punish you for like not only experimenting but just not being great with the systems. The systems are like easy to use. The ability to like really get good with them is there, but if you just want to like, you know, sort of push through and engage with like the bare bones stuff, like I think the game allows for that. And there are obviously varying difficulty levels, and I'm playing on normal because like I don't even want to like, just want to enjoy it, experience the story, meet some new people, and I'm having a great time. And like I said, the iconic Vanillaware style, like as soon as you see it, you'll be like, okay, definitely remember these folks and how they make their games look. And seriously getting some 13 Sentinels vibes in terms of look and feel and sound and music and stuff. So it's awesome. I'm really enjoying it. I probably got a long way to go with it, but I'm having a good time.
Well, it's good. I mean, anyone who was in that game club has something new to try, it sounds like.
Yeah. And it actually, and now that you mention that, in our Discord, we do have a game discussion open for Unicorn Overlord, and it's been very active. A lot of folks have. So if you're wondering why the Discord's a bit quiet, it's because everyone's in there. A good majority of folks are in there discussing.
Yeah, Unicorn Overlord. I had noticed. I was like, oh man, I can actually keep up with the conversation right now. What is happening? It's like, oh, everyone's in there. Yeah.
And it's been going really well. People are being very good. They're you know, captioning their spoilers, so there's no worry of going in there and being like, you know, spoiled for events. Everyone's kind of all over the place, and once you complete the first main mission of rescuing a specific character, you are sort of offered the ability to go in different directions. Like, the game does open up in a way that's like, okay, now that you've done this, you can kind of tackle how you want to complete the game from here. And I think it opens up a lot of different routes. So again, like, folks in the Discord have been very good to sort of cover their spoilers and still discuss like tactics and, you know, little things like that. So it's a great spot if you're starting out and you want to ask some questions. There's folks that are a bit further along. There's folks that are playing on expert. So go to the experts. That's what I say. I've already been in there asking questions because I'm like, what? Does this ever change, or is this any different? Like, what do I do here? Like, I'm at the point now where I've got so many characters that I'm probably going to go in there and be like, okay, what are the go-to formations? Because for me, I keep going with the characters I like. You know, so I'll have to jump in there and ask that question for sure.
Yeah, it's nice to have a little bit of community support, especially on one of these things, because it's like, you want to be able to ask very specific questions and not necessarily just like get a walkthrough type guide, right? Like,
yes. Yeah, because that's what I'm finding. Yeah.
Well, that sounds awesome. And like I said, I'm really, really glad that we have a really cool community to chat with about Unicorn Overlord and just other kind of tactical stuff and things that need conversations, and like where you don't 100% want the answer. And where I'm going with this is that I've been playing Hearthstone, and not so much in the Gamers Inn Discord, but definitely in our old Angry Chicken Discord. Like, I just, it's such a nice resource to have people to be like, hey, what are you playing? What are you doing? Like, what's really cool? Because today, we just got the launch of Whizbang's Workshop, which is the new expansion. It also comes with the rotation that comes with the new standard year. And the reason why I wanted to bring it up, because I don't talk about every Hearthstone expansion here, but because this is actually Hearthstone's 10th anniversary, which feels completely and utterly bonkers to me. Like, I know I was covering Hearthstone for almost a decade when we stopped Angry Chicken, but still, like, 10 years feels like so long. So anyways, it is the 10th anniversary of Hearthstone, and this new expansion is so cool. If you've been playing Hearthstone since the beginning, then I think it's definitely worth checking out. Like, the mechanics are fun. Like, the game is in a really good place, and it has been that way, I think, for probably the past year or so. I think the game's been really fun. It's been very balanced. It's been in a good place. But the thing about Whizbang's Workshop is they've basically taken all, like, a lot of old mechanics from the last 10 years. There's like some like thematic kind of like meme cards that are in there. Like, it's really done a good job of taking the past 10 years of Hearthstone and then repackaging it all together in this really interesting, really fun, really nostalgic expansion. So the whole idea is like, so Whizbang the Wonderful was a card that was introduced probably like, I want to say about 5 years ago, maybe. And so like this character, it's a Hearthstone specific character. And the whole idea is that he was experimenting with new decks. So you could have this one legendary and you just basically like put that one card in your deck. That was it. And you would queue up for a game. And then you get one of, at first it was 9. And then I think he was updated to have Demon Hunter and Death Knight decks as well. But basically, you could just like put the one card in your deck and then you would get a random class with a random or with the corresponding Whizbang deck. So you could look them up online. You could see what all the decks were, but you didn't have to actually own the cards. You could just own the one Whizbang legendary and then that was it. and you'd have these 9 different decks to play with. You couldn't choose them. It would pick a random one for you when you like got into your match. But it was a really good way to kind of like experience all the classes and play with a lot of cards that you didn't actually own. So this Hearthstone specific character, in his deck creation and his like experimenting, has his little workshop. And so it's basically like a whole bunch of like reworked and reimagined mechanics and cards from the past. So like there's one card that allows you, it's a 3-mana shaman card that allows you to discover a 4-mana minion and then set its stats to 7/7. So if you were playing Hearthstone like way, way back in the day, the 4-mana 7/7 was a like all over the place meme in Hearthstone, because shamans had this card that was printed that was cost you 4 mana that overloaded you, but the stats were 7/7. And it was like there was a curve at the shaman deck specifically that like basically blew everyone out of the water. It was super overpowered. And so like it's cards like that. There's also there's a jade card for druid that works very similar to how jade idols worked. That was back in the Mean Streets of Gadgetzan expansion. It's like really like trying to pull all of these random pieces of information out of my head from the last decade as to what all they're actually referring to. There's another like Tar Creeper type card, which is like less mana and a little bit smaller, but does the same thing where it has more attack. It's like a defensive card. It has taunt. It has more attack on your opponent's turn than it does on your turn. So like lots of, again, like I said, reimagining of past expansions and past mechanics. And obviously this expansion has its own mechanic as well. So there's a mechanic, a keyword called miniaturize. So you play the version of the card, whatever it is, and then you get a 1-mana 1/1 copy of the card in your hand afterwards. So like you basically get one version at like full cost, full stats, and then another version that's much, much smaller, which is really cool because a lot of them have like really powerful effects and you can do things like buff them in your hand or on your board, or, you know, like you might just want it to play the effect 2 times and you don't care about stats. Like, There's a lot of fun to be had. And the on top of all of the like nostalgia and the like meta references and everything else, it's also like the art in this expansion is so good. It's so fun. It's so colorful. It's so Hearthstone. So if you haven't played in a while or you're an old player and you're looking for a reason to come back, first of all, this time of year is the best time to get into Hearthstone because there's only 4 sets in standard. So you don't have to worry about not having a huge collection. It's a lot easier to catch up. And if you are a player who played like way back in the day, you're going to recognize a lot of what they're going for in this set. There's, like I said, a ton of nostalgia. So yeah, this 10th anniversary set from Hearthstone is just amazing. And apparently it was designed by Korra. So if you guys are familiar with Hearthstone, you're familiar with Korra, and she is a phenomenal person, and every expansion that she's created since joining the team has been amazeballs. So cheers to Korra. Well done. Clap, clap, clap. Whizbang's workshop has been a lot of fun, and I've only played it like a couple of times. Like, I've only played a few matches today, but it's been really, really fun. So yeah, go check it out.
Cool. So I'm looking at the announcement here, and so you had said it's Plendiferous Whizbang is the card. Is that the card that gives you a special experimental deck? Like, do you have to buy that card or do you just get it?
It was called Whizbang the Wonderful.
Maybe I'm looking at an old release. Or maybe this is, yeah, Whizbang's Workshop. Yeah, it's from today.
Whizbang's Workshop is the new expansion. The original card that the character is based on was Whizbang the Wonderful.
Oh, okay. So I'm looking at this new card. So it's a 4/4/5. Start the game with one of Whizbang's experimental decks. So is that the special card? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So the original card, because like, so there's rotations, right? So the original card when it first came in was one of Whizbang's wonderful decks. But yeah, it's the same sort of idea. You basically get one of a certain number of decks. There's usually one for each class, and you don't have to own any of the cards, but you don't get to choose your class going in. And actually, I think there's actually 2 I think there's two decks for each class because it's based on the deck recipes. So, and deck recipes are when you go into, it's something they added. When did they add it? I feel like it was a few years ago now. But basically, you have to own the cards, but you can, they're like a guide, I guess, for building. So when you go into your collection manager, if you choose like you want to build a mage deck, it'll be like, do you want to build a frost mage deck, a fire mage deck, or a custom mage deck? And so it gives you a little bit of more guidance if you're a newer player. So all of Whizbang's decks came from those deck recipes.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So it's just like, I mean, obviously I haven't played Hearthstone in a very long time, but I know that they're constantly adding new stuff to this game. And it always surprised me. I think I've said this years ago as well, is that I'm always surprised how often they add stuff to the game and how creative their expansions are. I think they've kind of moved away from, they've gotten into a bit of a pattern right now with the expansions, right? So now we're, so what is it? Is it three expansions a year now or is it four? I can't remember.
Yeah, it's three expansions a year, but each expansion has like the original, like I think it's 127 card expansion. And then there's a mini set that happens halfway through that follows a similar theme, but only has, shoot, I want to say 27 cards. Okay. I don't know why I have 27 in my head. But anyways, there's 100 and something, and then there's a smaller set that happens halfway through, and it basically like augments and is intended to change the meta a little bit in between expansions. So there are three expansions and three mini sets every year.
Mm-hmm. And them going with the Year of the Pegasus, is that the closest they're going to get to Year of the Unicorn? Like, are we going to have to wait?
Yeah, 100%. Like, that is, okay. We are never getting Year of the Unicorn, but that's okay.
Okay. I mean, that's fine. You'll have to just, you
it's
know,
close enough. It's close
find
enough.
Find unicorns elsewhere, I suppose. I still haven't come across like a living unicorn in Unicorn Overlord. It's just been the icon. And the ring. And so, but as soon as I see a real unicorn, a mystical deity that is a unicorn, I'll let you know. But maybe we're both still chasing those, you know, you won't find one in there's got to be a unicorn card though in Hearthstone, right?
Like, oh yeah, there is actually. Yeah. So, and this is what I mean by like referring back to the past. So in, oh shoot, I can't remember what expansion it was, but there was a point in time in Hearthstone history where Priest was terrible, like absolutely unplayable, like 20% win rate. They were awful. And they introduced a card. The first reveal that they did was a card called Purify, which was basically silence your own minions. And everyone freaked out because they were like, Priest is already unplayable. Like, what is this card? What is going on? Like, why is this the level of power that Priest is getting when they're so far behind everybody else? And at that point in time, Yang Wu, who was the executive producer of Hearthstone, said that maybe there's a unicorn Priest deck that, you know, people just haven't found yet. And it's this like elusive, mythical, mystical creature of a deck that, you know, is going to blow up the meta and Priest is going to be amazing. And so everyone was trying to find the unicorn Priest deck. So in this new expansion, they came out with a card and I'm totally blanking on what it is. quickly viewing all cards.
You can't just search for unicorn, just unicorn card, or just doesn't keyword it.
Oh my God. What's it called?
I'd help you if I could. I feel
like, I know. I feel like nothing. Their card library, because I'm looking it up right now, and I feel like their card library has not been updated yet. But anyways, the point is they made a Priest card with a unicorn on it. Maybe it's just taking a really long time to load. God damn it. they made a Priest card anyways with a unicorn on it, and it basically silences all your minions and then buffs them by +1/+2, I think. Anyways, so like that's what I mean. Like, so it's referencing like a thing that was never really like, it was never another card necessarily in Hearthstone, but it was like a community meme sort of thing, the looking for unicorn Priest. So yeah, it's not actually called anything to do with unicorns, but Yeah, it is a unicorn card, and it's like a unicorn flying with a rainbow coming out its butt. Like it's the perfect Joss card. I'm a priest main now. It's just I can't remember the name of the stupid thing.
But you have it. You have it.
Yes, I have it. I have two golden versions, actually, that I just opened randomly in packs. So I'm pretty sure someone on the Hearthstone team must have like changed the code in the background to make sure that I got two golden versions of that card. But yeah,
that makes sense.
So again, like I said, lots of like community references, lots of nostalgia. Like the set is really, really, really well done. If you are an old player returning to the game, or even not returning to the game, if you've just been playing the game for any amount of time, like there's something in this set for you. And it warms my heart. It's very wonderful. Like they've done a great job on this expansion. So go and check it out if you haven't played Hearthstone for a while. Even if you don't like go in and play, and like just go and look at the cards and kind of enjoy some of the references, because yeah, it's a really, really well thought out set. You can tell that the people who made it really, really love the game and have for a very long time. So yeah, go check it out.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I think that celebrating 10 years, you need to have folks working on that game that love that game. And I'm glad that it shows, for sure.
Another thing you should go check out is patreon.com/thegamersin, like Daniel Hachikumo and Babylon Redeemer have done. Thank you guys so much for your continued support of the show. Again, if you like what Ryan and I do and you'd like to support us, head on over to patreon.com/thegamersin. That brings us to the news section this week. We have no layoffs. We have no lawsuits. It's wonderful. We actually have a union formation at Activision. The QA workers have now unionized. I believe it's about 300 people, or was it 600 people?
I think this is 600. Yeah,
this is 600. Yeah, there was another one recently that was 300. ZeniMax was 300 QA workers, which is also under the Microsoft umbrella. That was last year. So 600 Activision workers now are underneath a union that has been recognized by Microsoft, which is awesome. As we've talked about in the last few weeks, with so many layoffs, unions are very, 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 very needed in this industry. So I think this is nothing but a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Microsoft has a labor neutrality agreement with the CWA, which is the major union for game developers. The
Communications Workers of America.
Yeah, I think now it's a critical time for developers to unionize. And I think the fact that Microsoft, being one of the largest employers of video game developers, now that they own ABK, it's just a matter of, I mean, I know it's not as simple as saying just a matter of organizing, but you know, Blizzard, I know, has been working on organizing for years. And I think by the end of this year, we'll be seeing more ABK workers unionizing and joining their fellow workers with the CWA. So like, this is the first step. I'm pretty optimistic that this is the first of many for this year. I think you're going to see a lot of developers moving in this direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I hope that it provides a little bit more stability. I think that's really what is missing in the industry right now. I think a lot of devs are feeling like they're putting their heart and soul into games, and games are selling really well, and then they're turning around and getting fired, and that just feels awful. So hopefully this is a start of a trend that's going to lead to more stability in the industry, because I think that's really what everybody wants. So yeah, I think overall thumbs up.
The more that we can get developers' voices heard, I think that's where unionization really comes into play, because when there are layoffs, you see all the quotes from the CEOs, and then you don't hear from the developers until they go to Twitter and announce that they've been laid off. Like, it's, I think also having a union gives the developers a voice at the table when there are these announcements of layoffs, for them to say like, and here's our take on it. And they will include those takes in these news articles. So like, I think it's a good step, and I want to see more.
Saber Interactive has also split from Embracer, which I think this is one we had covered. Was it last week?
Yes. So now it's official, and we've sort of got the split here in that Embracer will be taking, Saber will be taking 38 video game projects with it. So this is a pretty big split and kind of confirms how that split is going to sort of take place with the amount of developers. Although Tripwire, Aspire, and Beamdog are still with Embracer, it looks like Saber might be able to bring 4A Games and Zen Studios with them, depending on how the negotiations go for a price. But it sounds like that's a done deal. Like, that's going to be the split. So this is Embracer's move to sort of sell off more assets. And I mean, it goes back to like talking about having creative solutions. And I know like having $500 million to spend to save yourself from a sinking ship is not everybody's situation. But I think this is the best outcome that you can have from one of these scenarios where you have a parent company just like flailing miserably. So hopefully this helps stabilize it a bit. And then hopefully, because Embracer has a lot of projects, right? So like Embracer still has many studios under their umbrella. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I hope this helps and at least helps Saber Interactive remain sort of afloat. Yeah. And not attached to a sinking ship.
Very much so. The card was called Purifying Power, by the way.
Oh, that sounds...
Thank you, Hearthstone.
That sounds right. I got to look it up. So Purifying
Power. Hearthstone card.
I didn't write Hearthstone.
Oh, no.
The first what one was... it was like a religious article. Yeah. The pure of power compels
this
you.
This is about unicorns, Ryan.
I know. I didn't even put unicorn. Now I put Hearthstone. Oh, I got a 4-4. This is great podcasting. I got a 4-4. You're right. The Hearthstone website is not doing so hot.
No.
Oh, man. A rating 2.5 out of 5 stars. Like, that doesn't sound right. Jocelyn, you got to get in here and
clearly,
fix this.
That's clearly people who don't like unicorns enough. That's all that is.
HearthstoneTopDecks.com. I don't know if that's a reputable site, but... Anyways, yes, that is a unicorn with a rainbow coming out of its butt.
Yep.
Good stuff.
yeah, sorry art. For that aside there. Yeah, no, it's great good. Art, right? Yeah. So, yeah, again, Hearthstone, amazing. Improved Steam families, they are now in beta. So this is basically a library sharing initiative. So you can flag people who are in your family on Steam, and then you can basically share one big, huge library. So anything, like if Ryan and I were in a Steam family, then it would combine our libraries and we could play each other's games. If we wanted to play the same game together, we would need to make sure that we had enough copies that, like, basically, like if we wanted to play Dead by Daylight together, if I owned it and Ryan didn't, we couldn't do that. We'd have to buy another copy of Dead by Daylight for Ryan to play. If we're playing concurrently, otherwise I could play by myself, Ryan could play by himself. So they're doing a new, I guess, improved version of this. And obviously, now as a parent, I find the parental controls really interesting. And if nothing else, like even without the whole idea of parental control, I just find like the playtime stats, because you can get like a report of playtime for everybody. And it shows like day by day how much time they played and at what time of day. And it's really interesting. If you hover over, you can actually see what was played. I just like stats in general. So the gameplay stats look really, really cool. You can join the beta now, but the Steam family, they say, is intended for a household of up to 6 close family members.
Yeah. I was going to address that. Like, it seems... Look, like
it's like they're getting ahead of the whole like Netflix password sharing debacle.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because they like it could be something like that. But then I wonder if it so, for example, they talk about how developers can opt out of this program. And I could see that if they went with the understanding like, hey, families, all families are different. You know, there's no traditional family here that we're talking about. Like, families can be spread out.
Yeah, they literally say many shapes and sizes.
yeah. You can have siblings in university. You can have friends that you consider family. Like, I think that they are keeping it intentionally broad so that they don't have developers coming in and saying, well, Steam is encouraging these six people to share my one game and I'm suddenly losing out on sales. Like, I think the wording here is, you know, not necessarily like we're going to start checking IPs, but we are going to keep this sort of descriptor sort of broad enough where we don't have, you know, developers like, you know, removing their games from the program, because it is, mm-hmm. they can opt out at any time. But there are big titles like, you know, I think they even confirmed like Baldur's Gate 3 is in there. I mean, when you think about sort of sharing a library, like if you think about like, oh, one person buys Baldur's Gate 3 at launch, like that's a big game you're going to want to play large chunks of, and mm-hmm. Sharing that might be tough. Like, I almost feel like this is a nice feature to have, because I think that there's no other platform doing it this way. Like, there are family accounts, like Nintendo has a family account. It doesn't mm-hmm. limit you of who you can invite and stuff. But this is actually allowing you to share your purchases, which yeah. is a big deal. And I know that there were features like this already present within Steam, but it was a little mm-hmm. more cumbersome to set up and not as intuitive. This really feels like they've taken a lot of the UI changes they've made in a good way and have applied it to a feature that is very powerful.
Yeah, because I think Steam family sharing is something I had already set up. I feel like you and I might even be in a Steam family.
Yeah, I don't know. It feels like one of those things where,
or maybe I did it with Matt. That might have been it.
But
I feel like I would, because I remember like when I first looked at this, I'm like, didn't they already have this? And they
did. Yeah,
they had something like it. They had a couple of different features that they've now kind of combined into one and added to.
Yeah. And I mean, the biggest thing for me that they've appeared to add here is, you know, we talk about family management and approving purchases. So like yes. they have different levels. Like before it was like, you just invited someone to a family and
you were all just like, it's like a little group.
Yeah. This is a little more nuanced in that, like, yes, if, you know, we wanted to connect to our libraries, you know, we would both be set up as sort of adult accounts, but then you can also have child accounts. So for example, if, you know, Caden or Olivia get to an age where like they're ready to have their own Steam library, they could be set up as a child account and then you could approve purchases that they request, which honestly, like, is such a great feature because, and this mm-hmm. is present across a lot of parental control. Like, I can do it right now with our family link setup we have with the Google tablets for the kids. And they don't necessarily request for purchases, but they, you know, can go into the app store and say they want like a free app as part of the Play Pass or whatever. And I get a little notification, and it's just much easier than like risking putting the credit card information on the kid's right. device.
Well, like, how many new stores, especially when yeah. like these devices originally like opened their stores and stuff and storing your payment information started to be a thing. Like, how many times did we see stories where it was like, toddler spends $10,000 on, you know, in-game currency for Minecraft or something? Like, yeah. That was very common like 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's and the other thing that jumped out to me is there's a FAQ at the bottom of the link here, and it's what happens if my brother gets banned for cheating while playing my game?
And yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I wasn't too keen on this one because it's like, so it basically says like, if a family member gets banned by cheating for cheating while playing your copy of a game, you, the game owner, will also be banned in that game. Other family members are not impacted. So yeah. I like, it's tied to the game, not the player. I think,
but
that's
it also is kind of tied to the player, right? Because it's banning the player who did it, not just the game owner, right? So it's like they have some ability to track it because they're saying that other families are not impacted, but they're almost like putting the onus on you as the person who holds the license to say, like, it almost makes it sound like you should be aware of what people are doing with your copy of the game, which, like, I kind of understand in a maybe like not like in basically any other instance, like say if I have a car and I'm allowing you to borrow it and drive it, then yes, I should make sure that you are like have a driver's license and you're following the rules of the road and you're not, you know, drinking and driving and, you know, driving dangerously or whatever. Like those are all things that I would expect to be my responsibility. But like this is a digital video game. Like, you know, if I'm like, oh yeah, sure, Ryan, you can play my copy of Helldivers 2, why not? And then like you go and cheat, like how am I supposed to monitor that? Like I don't know what you're doing. Maybe I should. It seems like Steam is taking the position that I, as the game owner, should monitor what is done with the game, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with that when you're talking, especially in talking about like a Steam library. Like I'm pretty sure by this point anyone who's been on Steam for any significant amount of time is probably has libraries very similar to Ryan and I, where we have hundreds of titles in there. Like, I have no idea what people are playing, like, or, yeah. Or would have no idea what people are playing outside of, like, setting up, which I don't actually know. I didn't read into this too much, but, like, okay, yes, sorry, it does say that adult accounts can use parental controls to limit games that children in the family can access. So, like, that's as far as I would go, is I would be like, okay, DBD, Olivia, you're 3? Probably not. Like, you know, like... I could go through and like set controls for adults versus children, and that would be as far as I would expect my like liability to go. Like if you're an adult, you should be able to make your own decisions, and if they have the ability to see, which obviously they do, who is playing the game, like the cheater should get banned. And to me, full stop there, right? Like I think banning the game owner is an interesting choice and maybe not one I necessarily agree with.
Yeah. Although, you know, I can see it if we go back to the household thing and like it is a relationship of a parent and a child in the same house. Full disclosure, I haven't come across this yet. I'm just saying I'm expecting that.
You're trying not to throw Caden under the bus right now.
Not Caden, or I'm just like trying not to speak too far
right,
ahead
Abby
of myself.
Abby would be the cheater, right? To go back to the beginning of the show. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm ragging on her so much. I love that kid.
She's awesome. You know,
but and she is mischievous.
She is. She came home from school the other day. I got her off the bus, and Caden runs off the bus and says, "Is Abby a millionaire?" Like just. Livid. Is Abby a millionaire? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like yelling at me like, Abby's a millionaire. Did you know that? How did she become a millionaire? And I'm like, okay, come on, just get off the bus. And then Abby's, you know, taking her time to get off the bus, and she gets off the bus and she's got like a wad of Monopoly money.
Oh my God.
And she's like fanning around and like, you know, she's convinced it's real. And she's like, can you count it? Can you count it? And it's like the Monopoly money that has, it's the 1,000K one. Yep. It's like the higher level stuff. It's not like the ones we grew up with, which is like 1, 2s, 5s, and 20s. This is like, they're all in the 1,000Ks.
Inflation has hit Monopoly.
Yes. My kid's a millionaire with Monopoly money. I have to break it to her. Like, no, that's fake. I had to like remind her several times that it's not real money. And then in the morning, she's like, well, I'm going to go back on that bus and tell that person that this is Monopoly money. What kind of money is this again? Monopoly money? He's like, yes, it's fake. Not real. I hope you didn't give them anything for it.
Yeah, how did she get it? This is the next question.
Friend gave it to her and she did, I guess she did not relinquish anything for it. But anyways, so back to the kid responsibility thing. So I think that as a parent, we have to sort of be responsible for what our kids are doing. And if it's a child account and they're in our care, like I can kind of see that, like, yes, I am responsible to make sure that they're not doing anything. They shouldn't be on the computer cheating, being a real nasty on comms. Like I wouldn't want my kid to be doing that.
Yeah, that's fair. But yeah, if it's like an adult and an adult account, I guess that's what is in my head. Like, I don't want to police what Matt is doing, you know?
Yeah,
like-
exactly. Yeah. I don't want to, look, I don't want to worry that Ashley's like, you know, using like wall hacks in Titanfall or something, you know, like, I see that side of it too. And I think that like parent to a child, that responsibility, I can understand.
I think
that.
That's different, or should but, like, be different.
It should be different. But adult to adult, I think it's like, if someone is set up as an adult account, there should be like...
They should be responsible for themselves, period.
Exactly, 100%. But a child account, like, totally understand that, like, I should be held responsible for what they're doing because I should be parenting them.
Yeah, that's fair.
And making sure they're, like, getting good at Call of Duty the right way, not using some sort of whatever hacks they use these days. I have no idea. So, wall hacks, I guess. I don't know. Aim bots. Is that still a thing?
There you go. Probably.
Yeah. I don't know. But I think it's a really good step in the right direction. And, Epic always complains that Steam isn't doing enough for gamers. So I'd love to see what Epic does with their family library. Your move, Tim Sweeney.
We also got reports this week that Sony's going to be coming out with a PS5 Pro expected this holiday 2024. It's going to be up to 3 times faster than the PS5. So, Ryan, are you going to be in line for the PS5 Pro this holiday, or are you happy with your existing PS5?
So it's funny. I threw this story in here specifically because I was going to ask you the same question. So you've asked me. My gut reaction is, I don't think I want a PS5 Pro. I don't know why I'm struggling with that. I feel like I just bought the PS5, to be honest. Like,
I had the same thought. Man, didn't I just get that like last year? And obviously, no, it was, a little while ago now. But it does feel quick, I think. And like, my PS5 runs just fine. I think basically, like any new console, my decision would probably be driven by what games are going to be on the platform. And if there's something like, if the new Horizon game was coming out this holiday, I might be like, worth a second look. But I don't know. Like, I don't really think I can justify it, because if PS5 is fine, like the PS5 plays amazingly well. So it's not like I'm feeling like the Switch feels like it's getting long in the tooth, right? Yeah. But the PS5 doesn't feel like that to me. Like, everything I go to play on it plays amazingly. So I don't feel the need for an upgrade. Like, it's not feeling slow to me at all. Yeah. Maybe I just haven't played anything like... Well, no, because Final Fantasy 16 was like less than a year ago. And that had tons of like visual effects and like things that you would think would be traditionally taxing on a machine. And it was fine. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm definitely not feeling the urge to update, for sure. I feel like maybe I'd, like, if it was another year or two from now, maybe. And again, like, if there was a Horizon game, probably. But, yeah, even then, like, I might wait and see how the performance stacks up. Like, again, I don't feel the need. Like, even if there was a new Horizon game, I might not. Like, yeah, it feels fast.
Yeah. I think the difference with the last Pro leap was the move from 1080p to 4K. Like, there was that very distinct marketing jump of, hey, you have a 4K TV, now you can have a console. Like, that was the main reason I did the work to upgrade to the Xbox One X and the PS4 Pro. It was to have that 4K.
I didn't get the PS4 Pro. I think I got the Xbox. I did get the Xbox, but not the PS4.
Yeah. And, looking back, like, I think that there were a few games that just had a couple extra performance modes for the pros. And then obviously there was the whole Cyberpunk thing, but that's a whole different story. But I think this feels fast, even if it really on paper is not. Like, this is mid-generation, like, they want to have a refresh. Like, but as you said, it comes down to games. And I think we've been sort of spoiled with the performance versus quality modes that have been present in games on the PS5 and Xbox Series X and S that sort of allow you to feel like you're getting the right settings for you. Like, for me, I prefer, if there's a 60 frames per second mode, I'm going to choose performance mode, and then I'm most comfortable playing that. You know, it's how I played Jedi Survivor. It's how I'll likely play Rebirth when it comes out. Or sorry, when I pick it up, it's already out.
I was just saying, hasn't that been out for weeks now?
It's been out for weeks, but look, it's not out yet because I haven't decided to buy it.
Right, right.
We haven't talked about it here until it hits the Gamers Inn, the exclusive
it's
club.
It's not actually out.
Exactly. So I think that's my big thing, is like I'm feeling less inclined to jump to a pro version of these current consoles because we are already being offered differing ways to play these games, these high level games. Like Spider-Man 2 came out, I played performance mode, 60 frames. There were many options on how you could play that thing, and I think that, you know, obviously a pro version is gonna have like higher fidelity 60 frame per second modes with ray tracing, but for me, like, these games already look great. I don't need to buy another $700 console and go through the trouble of trying to sell my old one on Facebook Marketplace. Like, I kind of just want to save the money and effort for the Switch 2, which is coming out at some point in the next year. So
yeah, and that feels like an upgrade that is needed.
Yes, 100%.
I assume we still don't know all the specs of it, obviously.
Yeah,
but it's the next generation Nintendo console, so.
Yeah, yeah, but it's. Yeah, we'll see what this, you know, and we obviously had the leaks for Xbox mid last year, and you know, Sony and Microsoft, they say they don't share, you know, documents, but they sure do line up with how they release their hardware. So I'm sure this fall we'll have two half step consoles to look at and be like, wow, like that's a lot of money.
Yeah. And same thing on the Microsoft side. Like, my Xbox is running great. I use it every day. Like, it's like our media center upstairs right now. So like, it's doing everything. I've got my games on there. That's where I was playing Suicide Squad the other week. Like, everything's running fine. Like, I have no reason to update either one of them. So yeah, I think I'll be doing the same thing, is, you know, getting the next Nintendo update. But other than that, I think I'll probably skip this half-step console generation. But yeah, sorry, Sony. Sorry, Microsoft.
They got your money. It's all good. It's all good.
Yeah. All right. That's going to do it for us this week. If you guys want to join in the conversation, go head on over to bit.ly/TGI Discord. We've got a lot of great people in there giving tips on all kinds of games, including the one that Ryan talked about today, Unicorn Overlord. So go and check it out. You can also visit us on the web at gamersinpodcast.com or follow us over on Twitter. You can find me, Jocelyn, at JossPlays. Ryan is at RMurphy. And don't forget to follow the show at The Gamers Inn. Thanks for staying at The Gamers Inn. And remember, tune in next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.